and welcome to Learning English, the daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America in Washington. This program is designed to help people like you learn everyday American English. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us what makes a great college graduation speech. You will hear words and their stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana Mateo will tell us about what it means to be behind the eight ball. And then we present The Making of a Nation. Now, here is Pete Musto.
Imagine it is a beautiful spring day in the month of May or early June. You are sitting among a crowd of people at a large theater or stadium. Around you are hundreds of young people. They are wearing long robes over normal clothing and hats in the shape of a square. Why? You just completed a 2 or 4 year degree program at a college or university and are now attending a graduation ceremony. This event, also called commencement, is where schools recognize the students who successfully completed their degree programs. Suddenly, a person you may have seen on television stands up, walks in front of the crowd, and starts to say something like this.
Graduates, faculty, parents, and old people that just come to these things, good morning and congratulations to the Dartmouth class of 2011.
They are giving a speech that marks how important this special event is to the graduating students and their loved ones. Dilip Abhaysekara is a former president of an organization called Toastmasters International. Toastmasters operates in about 145 different countries. It helps to train people in public speaking. Abhaysekara says speeches have been a big part of graduations in the United States and other countries for about 100 years or more. He adds that colleges and universities carefully choose who will give a commencement speech. Schools often choose people who are famous or successful in fields like politics, business, or the performing arts. They do so in order to make the ceremony a final lesson for the students in addition to a celebration. Abhaysekara spoke to VOA Learning English.
Perhaps the public at large will get a glimpse into the forces that shaped this person, and they will also get a glimpse into what kind of message this person wants to leave in the hearts of the next generation of leaders.
Many famous people have given speeches at graduation ceremonies over the years. In 2016, some of the most well-known speakers were film director Steven Spielberg and businessman Peter Thiel. Most commencement speakers offer advice, such as believing in oneself or never giving up when life becomes difficult. But what makes a speech truly great? What are the qualities in them that graduates will remember for the rest of their lives? John Gabrielli is a professor of neuroscience at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He studies memory. Gabrielli says memories are created from events when a person experiences a strong emotional reaction. Graduation ceremonies often fill people with many emotions, including happiness and feelings of success. Yet while Gabrielli has heard many commencement speeches in his life, he admits he cannot remember any of them that well. Many speeches are similar, often just celebrating the students and thanking the people who have supported them. This does not make for strong memories, he says.
What we remember besides emotion is what is unexpected. So daily expected things we forget very quickly. So a commencement speaker has a challenge, if it's going to be memorable, to say something unexpected.
Gabrielli notes truly memorable commencement speakers either change the way the speech is given or make challenging, unpredictable claims. Take Michelle Obama, for example. She spoke at a graduation ceremony at the City College of New York in 2016, while her husband was still president. She told the graduates that every day she wakes up in a house that was built by slaves. She was talking about the White House. Here is another example. Actress Rita Moreno spoke at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. During her speech to the graduates, she began speaking this way.
I agreed to speak at this commencement and chose to bring the instrument. My choice, a voice to articulate, to lay it straight, for on this date my fate is to relate with rhythm and passion that you have a mission.
Jeffrey Cowan adds there are other ways a commencement speech can fail. Cowan is a professor of communications at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He was also once the director of VOA. He says speakers often forget public speaking is all about building a connection between them and the people in the audience.
The worst thing to do is to talk down to your audience. And there's often a tendency to do that, or to talk in a mechanical way. And the other thing that's terrible is when people lose their place in a speech and it becomes incoherent.
Cowan thinks the best commencement speeches center the audience's attention on a single idea. Often, this can come from a personal story from the speaker's own life. For example, businessman Steve Jobs told Stanford University graduates in 2005 about how he left college without completing a degree program. Jobs also spoke about learning he was dying of cancer and how that changed his ideas about the world. Cowan says the best speeches also present college graduates with a challenge. For example, in 2008, writer J.K. Rowling asked graduates at Harvard University not to be afraid of failure, but to learn from it. And in 2005, writer David Foster Wallace asked graduates at Kenyon College to try and understand and value other people's opinions. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, here is Ana Mateo with words and their stories.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we tell about expressions and how they are used in American English. preparing for this show is not always easy. Some expressions have complex roots. And Americans sometimes use expressions in some situations, but not others. Every week, I write and produce a new show. My goal is to have everything ready by Thursday. So, if I don't have my report written by Wednesday, I really feel behind the eight ball. In other words, I feel like I'm in a difficult situation. It will be hard to write the story, have an editor look at it, and then produce it by Thursday night. I don't like to be behind the eight ball. Nobody does. The expression behind the eight ball comes from the table game of pool. As you might know, pool is played with 16 small hard balls. 15 of the balls are either solid colored or have stripes, and they all have numbers. The other ball, known as the cue ball, is white. Players strike the cue ball with the end of a long piece of wood called a cue stick. The aim is to shoot the numbered balls into one of six open pockets around the edge of the pool table. You can play many different games on a pool table. One of them is called eight ball. In eight ball, players try to put the numbered balls into the pockets, with the eight ball the last to go in. If a player sinks the eight ball before all the other balls leave the table, he or she loses. You can put your opponent in a difficult position by leaving the cue ball behind the eight ball. The eight ball blocks your opponent. So if you are behind the eight ball, you are in a bad position. There is almost no way out. Another expression from the world of games is nearly the same as being behind the eight ball. It is a sticky wicket. A sticky wicket is a difficult or sensitive situation. This term comes from the sport of cricket. In the case of this expression, the wicket is part of the cricket field between the stumps, the poles or sticks stuck in the ground. The grass on the wicket is usually shorter than other grass, or there might not be any grass at all. So weather conditions may affect this area and how the ball moves. If the wicket is too wet or too dry, the ball can move in an unpredictable way. This makes it difficult for the batter. These days, cricket teams may use a cover for the wicket, but that hasn't affected the use of this expression. A sticky wicket is still pretty common in American English. However, if you don't want to use these expressions from the pool hall or cricket field, you can simply use the words dilemma or predicament. They also mean a difficult situation. We have finished Words and Their Stories for this week. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thanks, Ana. Now we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Steve Ember looks at the American-led invasion of Iraq in March 2003. It was part of the War on Terror President George W. Bush had declared after the Al-Qaeda attacks on the United States on September 11, 2001.
In October of that year, the United States led the invasion of Afghanistan. The purpose was to attack Al-Qaeda and the Taliban rulers sheltering the group's leader, Osama bin Laden. At the same time, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was proposing the possibility of military action against Iraq as well. American officials accused Iraq of supporting terrorism. They pointed out that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons on his own people. They said there were signs that he was also trying to develop biological and nuclear weapons. President Bush gave his annual State of the Union message to Congress in January 2002. He described American successes in closing terrorist training camps in Afghanistan. He also spoke of cooperation from Pakistan toward the same goal in that country. The president singled out three countries, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, as what he called an axis of evil. He said the United States would not wait to be attacked by terrorist groups or the nations that support them. And President Bush had this warning.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world by seeking weapons of mass destruction. These regimes pose a grave and growing danger. They could provide these arms to terrorists, giving them the means to match their hatred.
President Bush said that the United States would not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten U.S. security with the world's most destructive weapons. Iraq had been defeated in 1991 after it invaded Kuwait. The United Nations ordered Iraq to destroy all of its development efforts for nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. The UN had sent teams of weapons inspectors to make sure Iraq was following its resolutions. But since 1998, Iraq had refused to let UN weapons inspection teams into the country. President Bush and his administration argued that Iraq was making or hiding weapons of mass destruction, known as WMDs. He said if the United Nations failed to force Iraq to disarm, the United States might launch a military attack against the country. In September 2002, a year after the attacks on New York and Washington, Bush addressed the UN General Assembly.
We know that Saddam Hussein pursued weapons of mass murder even when inspectors were in his country. Are we to assume that he stopped when they left?
With that speech, he began making a case to the international community for an invasion of Iraq.
History, the logic, and the facts lead to one conclusion. Saddam Hussein's regime is a grave and gathering danger. To suggest otherwise is to hope against the evidence. To assume this regime's good faith is to bet the lives of millions and the peace of the world in a reckless gamble. And this is a risk we must not take.
Back in Washington, the president asked Congress to pass a resolution giving him power to use military force against Iraq. Congress approved the resolution in October. In November, Iraq agreed to permit UN weapons inspectors to return. After more inspections, the leader of the team reported back to the United Nations in February 2003. He said the team had found no evidence of weapons of mass destruction. But he also said Iraq was not cooperating with efforts to find out if suspected weapons had been destroyed and if weapons programs had ended.
The United States knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Any country on the face of the earth with an active intelligence program knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction.
Donald Rumsfeld was not alone in supporting the idea of a war against Iraq.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
Other supporters included Vice President Dick Cheney.
That he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
And neocons, or members of the neoconservative movement. In January of 2003, President Bush used his State of the Union speech to strengthen his case against Iraq.
Year after year, Saddam Hussein has gone to elaborate lengths, spent enormous sums, taken great risks to build and keep weapons of mass destruction. But why? The only possible explanation, the only possible use he could have for those weapons is to dominate, intimidate, or attack.
He said British intelligence reported that Saddam Hussein had tried to buy uranium from Africa. Uranium can be used to make nuclear weapons. Several months later, the White House said the intelligence was false. The president wanted the United Nations to approve military force against Iraq. Britain and Spain also supported military action. They asked the Security Council to pass a resolution approving military action against Iraq. But some of the countries on the 15-member Security Council were opposed. They included Germany, France, and Russia. They said inspections should be increased and that the use of force should only be a last choice. The United States withdrew the resolution. The United States and Britain decided on a plan to invade Iraq. There was strong support among Americans, but there was widespread international opposition. In February 2003, millions of people in hundreds of cities around the world took part in anti-war protests. Opponents argued that the United States would be violating international law by invading a nation that they said was not an immediate threat. There was no evidence that Iraq was involved in the 9/11 attacks, but President Bush said he wanted to prevent Saddam Hussein from supplying weapons of mass destruction to terrorist groups that might attack the United States or other countries. He also argued that the Iraqi leader was an evil dictator who had ordered the killing of thousands of people and should be removed from power. Bush made his intentions clear in a televised speech on March 17, 2003.
The United Nations Security Council has not lived up to its responsibilities, so we will rise to ours. In recent days, some governments in the Middle East have been doing their part. They have delivered public and private messages urging the dictator to leave Iraq so that disarmament can proceed peacefully. He has thus far refused.
And President Bush told Saddam Hussein and his sons to leave Iraq or face military action.
All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours.
The Iraqi leader rejected the demand. UN inspection teams had requested more time to complete their job, but they left Iraq 4 days before the American-led invasion began on March 20th.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
On March 20th, Iraqi time, Airstrikes by the United States and Britain began what was called Operation Iraqi Freedom. A number of other countries joined the war effort. The coalition quickly defeated the Iraqi military. On April 9th, United States forces took control of Baghdad. Iraqis and American forces destroyed a large statue of Saddam Hussein in the capital. The Allies controlled all major Iraqi cities. Saddam Hussein had disappeared into hiding. On May 1st, President Bush was flown to the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln to make an announcement.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
In the background, there was a banner reading, "Mission Accomplished." The government in Baghdad had fallen, but a deepening conflict in Iraq lay ahead. American troops and an American inspection team searched Iraq for weapons of mass destruction, but none were found. The intelligence used to justify the invasion had turned out to be wrong. Intelligence failures happen, but some Americans felt that they had been misled by the administration in its push to go to war against Iraq. The United States turned its attention to rebuilding Iraq and establishing a new Iraqi government. The Coalition Provisional Authority was created as a temporary government in Iraq. President Bush replaced a general with State Department official Paul Bremer as head of the authority. People rioted and stole from government buildings, museums, and banks. In many places, there was little or no electric power, running water, or trash collection. The Coalition Provisional Authority dismissed the Iraqi army and the government. Those people now had no jobs. The presence of foreigners in their country angered many Iraqis. Militants attacked coalition troops. They also attacked Iraqis and international organizations seen as cooperating with American forces. In some areas, longtime religious differences between Sunni and Shiite Muslims grew into armed disputes.
Today marks the third day of our road march toward Baghdad.
The invasion of Iraq was the most closely reported war in military history. At the start of the war, as many as 700 reporters and photographers were embedded with the troops, living and traveling with them. Also, blogs gave people the ability to immediately read what troops were writing about the war from the front lines.
I'm just glad to be a part of something like this that's hopefully going to free a lot of people that are oppressed and get a madman out of power, too.
In December 2003, United States forces captured Saddam Hussein. He was hiding in a hole on a farm near Tikrit. He was later tried by Iraqis for crimes against his people and hanged. But that did not mean the war in Iraq would end anytime soon. George Bush had become a war president. He had two wars to lead as commander-in-chief, one in Afghanistan and the other in Iraq. But he also had matters of domestic policy to deal with as chief executive in Washington. That will be our story next week.
That's our program for today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program, from The Voice of America.